Well, before we get into our study of Genesis this evening, there's an issue I need to address. And we're not going to open this up for discussion tonight. It needs discussion, and we welcome discussion. We're going to save it for a Beit Midrash sometime in the near future. But over here on the piano, you'll notice that we have the latest Messiah Journal. This is almost 100 pages, 98 pages, and wonderful articles, just great articles. We invite and encourage every family to take one. One per family, please, to make sure that everyone can get one. And great articles. But there's one article in here, it's about 25 pages long, that is causing quite a stir. For about the last year, First Fruits of Zion has been softening their tone, which I was very glad to see. They're softening their tone because they were getting a bit, I don't know if I should use the word legalistic, but a little bit firm and almost condemning. Almost. Of anybody who wasn't keeping the Torah fully and in a Jewish way, and they confess this. And I was a little concerned here a few years ago as I saw this tone kind of getting stronger and a little more rigid. But they've backed off of that. They've realized that does not cause good fruit. And I mean, I love these guys. We've had Boaz Michael, Daniel Lancaster, Toby Janicki in our home and our congregation on a number of occasions. These guys are my brothers and my friends, and I have a world of respect for them. But in this one article, and it's a good article, except for about 2.5 pages right in the middle, which you can just skip over. From about page 54 to about the middle of 57, don't read that part, okay? Just skip over that. What did he say, Margaret? What pages are those? I want to read those pages. I know what you're thinking. And the last few pages of the article, absolutely killer. They're incredible. They're wonderful. But what has happened, and I got to read an advanced copy of this article about 2, 3, 4 months ago. And I expressed my concern to them at that time. Because I'm on the theological advisory board for First Fruits of Zion, and so I offer my theological advice, as do others. And they have softened the article a bit, but here's the concern. This is the thing. When you read the article, what they're saying is that if you're a Jew, you're required to keep the Torah. I agree. Okay? This is your heritage. It was given to the Jewish people. You're to be lights to the nations. You're supposed to show us how Torah observance, Torah obedience looks. But if you're a Gentile, it's like, well, yeah, you should keep the Torah, but you don't have to, and it'd be good if you did, but... And that's the kind of feeling that's confusing. It's confusing. I think they've overcorrected a bit. So I just want to share some thoughts, some insights with you, and you make up your own mind. This is not a deal breaker for me and First Fruits of Zion. Far from it. Because we're all trying to come to grips with God and the Torah. And we all have the same goal, and that's to live a life that's exemplary in this world before God. We all agree that the Torah is for every person. The question is, to what degree does God really require Gentiles to obey it? And I'm not so sure that First Fruits of Zion and I disagree as much as maybe we're expressing it differently. But let me just share with you some remarks. And I know you guys are going to dive right into this when you get home tonight to see what all the hoopla is about. And you may read it and think, oh, what's the big deal? But let me just share some things with you. If you will, if I had my overhead projector, you could see it. But Matthew chapter 5, if you would turn there. Matthew 5, a wonderful passage. We'll start with verse 17. Most of you may have this memorized. Do not think that I have come to abolish the Torah or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to live them out properly. Okay, that's what it means, to fulfill them. I came to properly express them, live them out, flesh them out, interpret them. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not an iota, not a dot will pass from the Torah until all is accomplished. Therefore, whoever relaxes one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you, unless your righteousness excels that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, I have a question for you. It may sound like a dumb question. But he says, whoever does them, the commandments of the Torah, and teaches them, will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. Here's the question. Why? Don't raise your hand yet. You haven't thought long enough. Okay, I'll give you another 10 seconds to think. Why is the person who keeps the commandments and teaches the commandments, why will he be called great in the kingdom of heaven? Let's understand what we mean by the kingdom of heaven. He's not talking about heaven. He's talking about the kingdom of heaven, which is the kingdom that comes to earth, the millennial kingdom, the kingdom where Messiah will rule on earth. Okay? Who has an answer? All right, Dale.
My guess is that since the Savior, the Messiah, is the incarnation of the Torah, and he lives the Torah, walks the Torah, speaks the Torah, the more that we do with the Torah in our own lives, the more we become like him.
Now, what you're saying is exactly true. But it doesn't quite answer the question. But I'm not disagreeing with you at all. But there's a more specific answer to this question. Why is it that one who keeps the Torah, the commandments of the Torah, and teaches the commandments will be called great in the kingdom of heaven? Bill.
Is it perhaps because when the scripture says that he teaches them, it's because who would be taught the Torah? A Jew would know them. So mm-hmm. He would be teaching those who would not know or understand.
That's a good point. You've got to teach the commandments to someone who doesn't know the commandments, correct? Excellent point. I love that. But in fact, still I'm looking for a more... When you hear the answer to the question, you'll know, oh, that is the answer. These are all great points, wonderful points. Rob?
Possibly that during his millennial reign, we're going to govern with him. So therefore, we need to know and practice the commandments in order to facilitate them.
That is close enough. That is close enough. Here's what it is. Here's what it is. Why is the one who keeps the commandments and teaches the commandments going to be called great in the kingdom of heaven? Because in the kingdom of heaven, all the commandments will be taught and kept. All right? You follow me so far? Which is, I mean, it's so obvious that you may have not just quite seen it that way. In the kingdom of heaven, all the commandments will be taught and they will all be kept. Now, listen to this. When Yeshua taught his disciples to pray, he prayed, "Your kingdom come." Okay, he didn't say, "Bring us all into your kingdom." No, he's saying, "Your kingdom come. May your will be done on earth as it is in heaven." What is his will? The Torah. You see, one who is keeping the commandments now and teaching others to do so is saying, I believe so much in the kingdom to come that his kingdom is going to come to this earth. He's going to come. He's going to reign right here with us. I'm living my life that way now. That's my faith. It's an expression of your faith in his word. You understand? Otherwise, you're going to be embarrassed when his kingdom comes and you will have claimed to be his servant all your life and you don't know his commandments and you haven't been keeping them and you haven't been teaching them. In Hebrews, it tells us to exhort one another, to be keeping the commandments, to exhort one another onto good works and so much the more as you see the day approaching. And you know what? That's a prophecy, I believe, because as we near the time of Messiah's coming, I see more and more and more of his followers keeping the commandments and teaching the commandments. That's why Beth Tikkun is here, and so many other congregations who are doing and studying the things that we do and we study. Because when His kingdom comes, the Torah is our constitution. It is our book of instructions, our book of laws for kingdom life. You see? Now, if you really believe His kingdom's coming, don't you want to be able to identify with that kingdom now and to begin to live out those commandments now in your life? So, I really believe that all of the commandments of the Torah, all of the Torah is for all of us, because the kingdom is for the whole world. It's for the whole world. Now, the troubling phrase I find in this article, the troubling phrase, it just kind of made me, you know, kind of wince every time I read it, was it uses the phrase, the more Jewish aspects of the Torah. As if Gentiles are excused from keeping the more Jewish aspects of the Torah. And it gives examples, like the Sabbath, wearing tzitzits, and other kinds of things. Let me give you my opinion on this. It may sound a little surprising, but I want you to think it through. You make your own opinion, make your own decision. I don't think the Torah has any Jewish aspects, because the Torah was not written by the Jews. It only has godly aspects, because the Torah was given by God. Okay? But I really mean that. I don't see any Jewish aspects in the Torah. Now, the only possibility is physical circumcision. And I'm not going to get into that tonight, because I did a whole hour plus teaching on it back on May 9th. Look at the Genesis 17, chapter 17 teachings. On the internet, you can get a CD of it somewhere. But we did the whole thing, because it may be shocking to learn that nowhere in the Torah is physical circumcision commanded. It never specifies what is to be circumcised. Listen to the teaching. Now, let's move on. There are no Jewish aspects to the Torah, in my opinion. Let's take an example. What if instead of to the Jewish people, God had given His Torah to the Japanese people? All right? He had given this Torah to Moses-san. Moses-san! Write down my Torah! Yes, so Adonai-san, I will do, you know. And so the Torah would have been lived out, and maybe He'd have brought them to the land that's known as Israel, and the women would have worn the round pointy hats, people would eat with chopsticks, and the guys would wear samurai swords. In other words, you would see the Torah lived out in a Japanese culture without any conflict. And then we would come along, the Gentiles, the non-Japanese, and we decide, we love this Torah, we love the God of the Japanese, we want to keep the Torah. Then all the women started wearing round pointy hats, we all eat with chopsticks poorly, and the guys are all wearing samurai swords. And somebody say, why are you doing that? Because I'm Torah observant. Where does it say wear a samurai sword in the Torah? Where does it say to eat food with little sticks? You see, you've got culture, and you have Torah. Here's a better example. Let's say you're starving. You're at the brink of death. And someone comes to you with a bowl of delicious, hot, nourishing food. And they bring the bowl and put it in front of you. You look at the bowl and you see a Star of David on it. You see a flag of Israel on it. Maybe a menorah on the side. You say, well, I don't like that bowl. What difference does it make whether you like the bowl or not? Maybe you love the bowl, maybe you hate the bowl. It's what's in the bowl that gives you life. God gave His Torah to the people, to Abraham and to his children. And you know, when you come to love the Torah, you're probably really going to come to love Abraham and his children as well, the people of Israel. As you come to love the Torah, you may come to love the culture of the Jewish people, the Middle Eastern culture of the Jews, and also the Eastern European culture of the Jews. Because most of what you see with Jewish people living out the Torah is Jewish culture. Okay? You see the Torah dressed in Jewish culture. And the culture is beautiful. It's wonderful. The traditions of Havdalah, not commanded in the scripture, but it's a beautiful tradition, so full of meaning. Lighting the Sabbath candles. You know, that all the ways they fulfill the commandments are wonderful and beautiful. That's the bowl. You don't eat the bowl. But the bowl's a wonderful container. You see? But it could be a Japanese container. You follow what I'm saying? It could be an American Indian container. Then we'd all be wearing feathers in our hair and living in wigwams and teepees. But still, Torah doesn't conflict with the Torah in any way, shape, or form. You understand what I'm saying? So, I don't think there are any more Jewish aspects of the Torah. I think what we can see in the world around us, and as we read books, we see Jewish expressions of Torah commandments. And I think we need to make that distinction. I think this is the correction. If I could express and correct one thing in the article and with the my wonderful brothers at First Fruits of Zion, it would be make the distinction between the Torah and the bowl. Make the distinction between the two. That's all I would say. So I don't want to spend more time on this than this. There's so much more that we could say. But we'll finish with this. 1 John 3:4. Again, I wish I had my overhead, but I don't. So we'll have to do it the old way of actually looking it up in the Bible. 1 John 3:4. 1 John chapter 3, verse 4, it says, everyone who makes a practice of sinning also practices lawlessness. Sin is lawlessness. Here's the complete Jewish Bible translation. Everyone who keeps sinning is violating Torah. Indeed, sin is violation of Torah. Torah describes what righteousness looks like. And to violate Torah is sin. But I have news for you. Every single one of us, as much as we try to keep Torah as Gentiles, we sin, we mess up, we miss the mark. And every single Orthodox Jew does as well. We may miss the mark by shooting to the left, whereas they miss the mark by shooting to the right. We may shoot too low, but they shoot too high. And by adding to the Torah, they have marred and reduced the Torah. And Christian believers, simply by poor teaching, bad traditions, by taking away from the Torah, have marred and reduced the Torah. And so all of us mess up, but the Torah is our aim, it's our goal, it's our target. And just because you don't hit exactly the middle of the bullseye doesn't mean you shouldn't even be aiming. I remember when the Olympics were on here some time back, I was fascinated watching the archery. And these guys had these incredible bows, you know, and they're shooting at these targets. I could hardly see them. And they're pulling these things back, and they're dropping these arrows in. And the whole time, I never saw one arrow hit the very middle of the bullseye. They hit in the bullseye, they hit the edge of the bullseye, maybe a little out of the bullseye. I never saw it hit the exact middle of the bullseye the whole time I watched. Not one. Some were closer than others, but the bullseye is what we're all aiming for. You follow? We all mess it. We all mess up. And so, any place we fall short of the Torah, are we sinning? Yeah, we miss. Because the katah, the Hebrew word for sin, means to miss the mark. You know, our aim should be getting better. It shouldn't be getting worse, it should be getting better. And so let's keep getting better. So, those are just some thoughts to share with you. Again, I see some hands that have been going up while I talk. I've been ignoring you rudely. But I don't want to turn this into a Beit Midrash. I'll save this for a Beit Midrash. And everyone's had a chance to read the article. And I'm telling you, the last five, six, the end of the article is absolutely dynamite. It is dynamite. It's a great article. It's just from 54 to the first half to 57 that you can just kind of skip over. If you can discipline yourself to skip over that, if you can do what Adam and Eve couldn't do, if you can avoid eating that fruit, you'll love the article. You really will, okay? All right. Well, let's get on to Genesis then. Last week, we talked about history of the church as you've never heard it. And if you missed that teaching, I hope you get that, because I think it, even though it's a long one, I think it's a foundational teaching to understanding of the word kahal, or the word Greek word ekklesia. But I do want to draw your attention to one final little capping thought on this. We looked at Jacob and the wrestling match with the person who I believe is actually Yeshua. I believe is a pre-incarnate appearance of Messiah, but who he wrestled with. And then we also looked at Matthew 16. And maybe we should turn there just for a moment to read through that to refresh our memories. I want you to look at some parallels. Because Matthew 16 is a very profound statement by the Master. And we'll start with verse 15. He's speaking to his disciples. Now, this is some time into his ministry. They've been walking with him for some time now. I'm not sure exactly how long. If I was a better Bible scholar, I could probably tell you how long it had been. It had been a year or 2 years. But he says in verse 15, he said to them, "Who do you say that I am?" Simon Peter answered, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." And Yeshua said to him, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, because flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father is in heaven." In other words, he's saying, nobody told you that, and I didn't tell you that. It's my Father in heaven who revealed that to you. "I also say to you that you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, my kahal, and the gates of Hades will not overpower it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." Then he warned the disciples that they should tell no one that he was the Messiah. And then from that time, Yeshua began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem, suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes, and be killed and be raised up on the third day. Peter took him aside, began to rebuke him, saying, "God forbid it, Lord, this shall never happen to you." But he turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are a stumbling block to me, for you are not setting your mind on God's interest, but man's." And then Yeshua said to his disciples, "If anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me." I just want to draw your attention to some parallels between Jacob's wrestling match. And remember, the wrestling match he had was an introduction to the next 20 or so years of his life. The next 20 or so years of his life would be a wrestling match with God. So we know that Jacob had walked with God while he lived at home in Isaac's tent. And even when he went off to spend 20-some years with his father-in-law, Laban, his uncle who became his father-in-law, and worked for his wives and his children and his cattle, he still walked with God. Peter had walked with Messiah for a couple of years, I'm assuming, maybe 3 years, because it's coming up close to the time of Messiah's crucifixion. When Jacob wrestles, when he realizes, something dawns on him, this is not my enemy Esau, this is God. And he asks him, "What is your name?" Because something had dawned on him, he knew who this was. And of course, what did the man answer him? He says, "Why do you even ask me what my name is?" But over here, in this account in Matthew, Yeshua is asking disciples, "Who do you say that I am?" And then when Peter says, "You're the Messiah, you're Son of the living God," he said, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, because flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father in heaven." In other words, Jacob and Peter both had a revelation, Jacob of who God is, and the other of who Messiah is. And they both received a blessing. God blessed Jacob, and Messiah blessed Peter. They both had a name change. Jacob became Israel. Simon becomes Petros, the rock. All right, you following me so far? And then they immediately had a fall Jacob went to Shechem in disobedience. And you know what a tragedy that was. And then Peter spouts up, "Oh Lord, this will never happen to you." And he says, "Get behind me, Satan." He went immediately from a revelation of who Messiah is to aligning himself with Satan. Jacob did pretty much the same thing. And you're going to notice that Peter's wrestling match with God begins. He was always the one so impetuous to jump into something only to be embarrassed and have to shrink back. "Oh, don't wash my feet." "Well, if I don't wash your feet, you can't have any part with me." "Oh, wash me all over." "You don't need a complete shower. You just need your feet washed." All right? "Lord, I'll never leave you. I'll never abandon you." Before the cock crows three times, you'll deny me three times. And he even cursed his name. He rushes in and slices off the Roman soldier's ear, you know, and he's just so impetuous. And then Yeshua says, "Put your sword away," and he has to put the ears, puts it back on. You're always picking up after Peter, always having to clean up the mess, kind of like with Jacob, you know, in this next part of his life. And just as Jacob thought he had lost his beloved son, Joseph, Peter thought he had been instrumental and lost forever Messiah ben Yosef. But they were both received, their beloved sons of Joseph, Joseph and the son of Joseph back from the dead. But you see what's happening here? But both of these became places of new beginnings. Upon this rock, I will build my kahal. Upon this revelation, the spiritual revelation of I am. And it was there in that wrestling match that God really began to build a kingdom for Jacob. Oh, he had his sons all right, but Benjamin is still on the way. And then going down to Egypt and coming out of Egypt, this birth. I remember a few weeks ago, Ben, I think it was, just sharing with us how the whole coming out of Egypt, you know, the few souls going in and then this huge nation coming out, it is a picture of birth. And crossing through the water and the plagues. It all is a spiritual image of a birth. And God's about to create this great kahal of nations that he promised Jacob. And he's about to do that when he brings them out of Egypt. So anyways, I just want you to be aware of these parallels because it will help open the scriptures to you, I hope. All right, let's get right into the same chapters we were in last week, but we're going to just look at a couple other details. Next week, we'll be talking about prayer. We're going to be in our new building the following week, and then we want to start our study of Joseph, which is just the icing on the cake of the book of Genesis. What a wonderful, wonderful account that is. No, if you want to read ahead, and most of you know this already, but there's no character in the Bible, no character in the Bible anywhere whose life more clearly parallels and is a picture of Messiah's than Joseph. Nobody. Nobody. And so I challenge you to be reading ahead, reading the life of Joseph, getting intimately familiar with the details, and then looking for parallels. All right? Like Joseph was the beloved son of his father, Yeshua, beloved son of his father. Joseph was sent to find his brethren in the field. Yeshua was sent to find his lost brethren in the field. Okay? And when he got to the place they're supposed to be, they weren't there. And the person tells him, remember Joseph meets this guy, and this guy says, "Oh, I heard them say they're going to Dothan." You know what Dothan means? Double law. Legalism. They're supposed to be here. No, they went to legalism. I mean, it just goes on and on and on and on and on. It's just an amazing, amazing study. So I encourage you to be reading ahead. All right, anyways, back to chapter 35. We have this kind of cryptic verse in verse 8. Deborah, the wet nurse of Rebekah, died. Now, Rebekah, remember, is Jacob's mother. How did Jacob know that Deborah died? It sounds like Deborah was with Jacob. And the theory is that Rebekah had told Jacob, that we know this, Rebekah told Jacob, "You go to Padan Aram, you go to my family there, and then I will send a messenger to you and tell you when to come back." And the possibility is that Deborah, and she would have come with a contingent of people, of course, it's possible that Deborah was that messenger. And so Deborah had been with Jacob and his family for a while, but on their way back, she died. And she was buried below Bethel, below the plateau. And he named it Alon Bachut, which is mentioned also in Judges chapter 4. And God appeared to Jacob again when he came from Padan Aram, and he blessed him. And God said to him, "Your name is Jacob. Your name shall not always be called Jacob, but Israel shall be your name." Thus he called his name Israel. And God said to him, "I am El Shaddai." El Shaddai, the one who supplies. You know, at Passover we sing that song, Dayenu. It would have been sufficient, right? Dai means sufficient. Shaddai means a sufficient one. Be fruitful and multiply, a nation and a kahal. The first appearance of the word church was back in a few chapters earlier. This is the second appearance of the word church, kahal. A kahal of nations shall descend from you, and kings shall issue from your loins. The land that I gave to Abraham and to Isaac I will give to you, and to your offspring after you I will give the land. And God ascended from upon him in the place where he had spoken with him. And then, let's move right on down to verse 16. They journeyed from Bethel, and there was still a stretch of land to go to Ephrath, or Ephratah, depending on your translation. Ephratah means fruitfulness. The middle letters, the pra or pre, is the word for fruit. When we have the blessing over the cup, we say bore pre hagafen. Okay, who creates? Bore creates pre fruit hagafen of the vine. So Ephratah or Ephratah, as it's pronounced, means fruitfulness. When Rachel went into labor and had difficulty in her childbirth. And it was when she had difficulty in her labor that the midwife said to her, "Have no fear, for this one too is a son for you." So it sounds like possibly this son is born breech, because the nurse could tell it was a boy, but it hadn't quite been born yet. I don't know. And it came to pass, as her soul was departing, for she died, that she called his name Ben-Oni, which means son of my sorrow. But his father called him Ben-Yamin, which means son of the right hand, son of the right. Thus Rachel died and was buried on the road to Ephrath, which is Bethlehem. So Benjamin is born between Bethel, house of God, and Bethlehem, house of bread. Jacob set up a monument over her grave. It is the monument of Rachel's grave until today. Israel journeyed on, and he pitched his tent beyond Migdal Eder, which is the tower of the flock. Now these terms, Bethlehem and Ephratah, tower of the flock, they're found in a prophecy in Micah, which we'll look at a little bit later if we have time. Micah chapter 4, all prophesying the birth of Messiah. Okay, so Rachel's grave and the place of Messiah's birth, Bethlehem, the tower of the flock, where this is the watchtower, they could look out over the flocks and keep a good eye on them. These are all elements in the story of the birth of Messiah. Now, I want us to look at this person, Benjamin. Benjamin is absolutely unique among the 12 sons of Jacob. Joseph and Benjamin both are very unique. But here are the things. If I had them overhead, you could see them all. If we're a skiff, we'd all go sailing. But Benjamin is the only son born to Israel. All right? Just like Isaac was the only son born to Abraham. Ishmael was born to Abram. Isaac was born to Abraham. The other sons were all born to Jacob. Benjamin is born to Israel. You follow? He's born after the name change. His birth is connected to the birth of Joseph. Now, take a look at Genesis chapter 30, verse 24. Genesis 30, 24. Now, the name Joseph comes from the word asaf, which means to add. And when Joseph was born, Remember, Rachel had only two sons, Joseph and Benjamin. When Joseph was born, why did Rachel name him Joseph? This is very interesting. It's easy to miss. Let's start with verse 23. Genesis 30, 23. She conceived and bore a son and said, God has taken away my disgrace. So she called his name Yosef, saying, may Adonai add on for me another son. So Joseph's name is connected to Benjamin. May God Yosef me another son. And he did, Benjamin. So Joseph's name actually comes as a foretelling of Benjamin's birth. Let me tell you right up front who Benjamin's a picture of, and you'll pick this up easily as we go through. Benjamin, the last son of Jacob, the 12th of the sons, the little one, he is a picture of those descendants of Abraham, those Jewish people who have always believed in Yeshua as their Messiah. They have looked for his coming before he came, and they accepted his coming when he did come, and all through the last 2,000 years, there's been this little group of people, of Jewish people, who have loved Yeshua the Messiah. There's always been a string of them. Always. And everything about Benjamin's life is a picture of this group of people. They are children of Israel, not of Jacob. Their birth is connected to Joseph's birth, and Joseph always is a picture of Messiah. Benjamin was the only son born in the land. The others are all born outside the land. He was born in the land of Israel. He was the only son who did not bow down to Esau. Anybody tell me why Benjamin didn't bow down to Esau? He wasn't born yet. All right? He was one who never bowed to Esau. He was the one son who did not participate in the sale of Joseph. As we get to the story, we're going to see how the other brothers betrayed Jacob. They betrayed Joseph because of their jealousy and hatred for him. They sold him into slavery. But Benjamin was not a participant. Now, we're not specifically told he wasn't. But we can build from this and from the Jewish histories. We know that because Joseph and Benjamin were the sons of Jacob's beloved wife, Rachel, he'd kept them back. He sent the other sons to shepherd their flocks. He didn't hear from them for a long time, so he sent the older of the two boys, Joseph, to go find them. And we can very safely assume that he held Benjamin back. He was born on the roadside, not at home. In other words, he was in progress to home when he was born. He was like a sojourner. He was born a sojourner. He wasn't born in Padan Aram. He wasn't born in Bethel. He wasn't born at Jacob's new home in Hebron. He was born on the way. But he's born very near Bethlehem and Ephratah and fruitfulness. He's born very near the place where Messiah Yeshua was born, a place of fruitfulness. Remember how Joseph tested his brother's love? He tested his brother's love. First thing he said, you got to bring Benjamin down with you, because Jacob wouldn't let Benjamin go down to Egypt with the other brothers. He kept him back. He's the only son I have left of Rachel. But Joseph said, unless you bring Benjamin down, your little brother, then I'm not going to let you guys go. So he kept Simeon as a hostage. And they went back home. Jacob says, go back to Egypt, get more food. They said, we can't go back unless we take Benjamin with us. Remember the story? Hope you've heard the story of Joseph. And so Jacob finally relented. He says, take some gifts to this leader of Egypt. And they took these gifts. They took Benjamin. And when Joseph saw Benjamin, he wept over him. And this really brought out the emotion and the love in Joseph. But then when he filled their sacks and sent them back, he put a silver cup in Benjamin's bag. Let them get a little ways out of town. Then he sent his messenger. He says, why did you guys steal my divining cup? Well, we didn't steal it. Whoever's bag you find in, you can put him to death. He can be a prisoner forever or something like that. So they go through every one of the brother's sacks. They come to Benjamin, and there it is. And so they all come back. And now this is so brilliant. Joseph was just a genius because he wanted to see. He knew how they treated him. And so now he wants to see, how are you going to treat Benjamin, my brother, the other son of Rachel, the other favorite of the father? Are you going to sell him out like you did me? He wanted to see if their hearts had changed. And then Judah speaks up. He says, take me. I'll be your slave forever. But don't break my father's heart. Let this little one go home. See, Judah is the one who sold him out. Judah is the one who sold him into slavery. And now he's given himself as a hostage for his brother. And it was at that moment, Joseph sent everyone else out of the room except for his brothers. And then he said, Ani Yosef, I am Joseph. And that's when he revealed himself. I think the day is coming when the Jewish people as a whole, instead of looking at their believing brethren as son of my sorrow, they're going to realize that these believing brothers are really sons of the right hand. They're the ones who are the truly spiritual ones. And when they're willing to lay their lives on the line for their believing brothers, who in the past they thought were heretics, they hated them. Because as a Jew, if you're an Orthodox Jew, you become a believer in Messiah, I mean, you're treated as a dead person. And your family will sit shiva over you for 7 days and mourn you as if you had died. But I think the day is coming. The day is coming somehow when the Jewish people will turn to their Messiah and they'll look at their little brothers, these ones that have loved Yeshua and recognize him as their Messiah. The ones that said, you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. And they'll say, you're one of us. And if somebody's going to do something to you, they have to go through us. Somehow, I don't know how it's going to happen, but I look for that day to come. And when it does, Messiah is going to reveal himself to all the people of Israel. Ani Yeshua. See, right now, Yeshua looks to the Jews like Joseph did his brothers. He looks like an Egyptian. Looks like a Gentile. You know, he talks Egyptian. He looks Egyptian. He dresses Egyptian. He's not. What does he have to do with us? But thou art a God who hides himself. Thou art a Messiah who hides himself as well. And when they begin to realize that their brethren who believe in Yeshua are still their brethren. When Israel opens its arms to its brothers who believe in Yeshua as the Messiah and embraces them, the Messiah, I think, will reveal himself to them. That's something we should pray for. All right. Benjamin receives a portion 5 times greater than his brothers. That's in chapter 43, verse 34. Joseph calls Benjamin my son, which is interesting. He was his brother, but he calls him my son. Now, you have to understand that in Hebraic thought, to call someone your son doesn't mean that he's your biological offspring, like Paul in 1 Corinthians 4 that had been read during the prayer service. Paul refers to Timothy as his son, though they were not related in any way. What does he mean? It means that he's my disciple. He is living his life the way I have taught him. And when you look at the way he lives his life, it looks like the way I live mine. He's my son. So to live your life like someone else, to be a disciple and live your life like your rabbi, is to be that rabbi's son. So I think that's what the Holy Spirit is speaking to us through this. Because Benjamin's life looks like Messiah's life. These people who are represented by Benjamin live a life like Messiah's. So he calls him my son and he speaks a blessing of grace over him. The word grace is used. That's in chapter 43, verse 29. Now Benjamin's the only son to have a name change. Reuben's called Reuben, Issachar is called Issachar, Judah's called Judah. But Benjamin, he gets his name changed several times. Now, Joseph did get his name changed by Pharaoh, but that doesn't count, all right? Benjamin got his name changed by Jacob and by God. When he's first born, Rachel's dying breath is, Ben-Oni, son of my sorrow. But then Jacob speaks up and says, no, his name will be Benjamin, son of the right hand. Remember, the right side's the spiritual side, right? Son of the right hand. But in Deuteronomy 33:12 is the last day of Moses' life. Moses speaks a blessing over each of the tribes. And when he gets to the tribe of Benjamin, it says this. Oh, of Benjamin, he said, may Adonai's beloved dwell securely by him. He calls him Adonai's Yadid, Adonai's beloved. Isn't that interesting? So he's son of my sorrow, son of the right hand, and he's the beloved of Adonai. Only one other person the Bible's called the beloved of Adonai, and that's Solomon. And when you realize that the temple that Solomon built was built in the territory of Benjamin, kind of all starts to fit together, doesn't it? Now here's what the whole verse says. You ready for this? Deuteronomy 33:12. Moses says of Benjamin, may Adonai's beloved dwell securely by him. He hovers over him all day long and rests between his shoulders. That word for shoulders can be shoulders, like shoulder blades, or slopes, like a hill. It could be either one. And like I said, the temple was built in the territory of Benjamin. In fact, it's built right on the border of Benjamin and Judah. And if I had an overhead, I forget saying if I had an overhead. I'm like an Italian trying to talk without using his hands. I cannot teach without an overhead. But if you look at a map of the temple, you'll see, if they have the borders drawn, that the border of Judah came right down along one side of the altar, across the bottom, and then on down. So outside of the altar was in Judah's territory, but the altar and the temple itself were in Benjamin's territory. The border between the two territories went right there, right down the side and around the corner of the altar. That was where Judah and Benjamin came together. And the rabbis say that these three lines spoken over Benjamin refer to the three temples. Solomon's temple, the second temple, Herod's temple, the one the Messiah walked and taught in, and then the third temple, the one that's to come. Because the first line says, may Adonai's Yadid, may Adonai's beloved dwell securely by him. This refers to the first temple, which was filled with God's glory, which was built by God's other beloved, Solomon. 2 Samuel 12:25 is where Solomon is called the Yadid. So it refers to the first temple. But the second line says, he hovers over him all day long. The first one, when he says he dwells securely by him, but here it says it hovers over him. And the sages say in the second temple, in Herod's temple, the one Yeshua came to, the Shekinah didn't dwell inside that temple. The ark was not there. It was never filled with the Spirit like the first temple was. The smoke didn't come billowing out of the temple. There was God's glory settled on it. That never happened at the second temple. But God always hovered over it. He always hovered. But then the third line says, and rest between his shoulders, or rest on his slopes. And that word for rest is the word shekan again. Shekan is used in the first. The word to dwell is used in the first line. May Adonai's beloved shekan securely by him. As using the third line. And you know, God's presence shekans between his shoulders. So it's used in the first or the third, but not in the middle. He hovers in the middle one. Interesting, isn't it? First temple, second temple, third. So there's another interesting thing too. You know, at the end of Jacob's life, he blesses each of his sons. He goes through them in order from Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, right on down through, then Joseph, the 11th son, then Benjamin, the 12th. But at the end of Moses' life, Moses also blesses the 12 tribes, but he mixes up the order. He starts with Reuben, which is number one. That one's fine, but then it gets all goofed up after that. He goes from Reuben to Judah, who's the 4th son. And then it goes from Judah to Levi, who's the 3rd son. From Levi to Benjamin, who's the 12th son. Then after Benjamin to Joseph, who's the 11th son. What's this all about? Did Moses forget what order the sons are born in? Of course not. It's all purposeful. Because you see, Judah was the area where the temple was built. Because Judah's territory came right down by the altar, all right? Right down along the side and across the bottom, and that was Judah's territory. Then after that is Levi, because Levi ministered in the temple. The tribe of Levi were the priests. And then Benjamin, because the altar and the temple itself were in Benjamin's territory. And then Joseph is mentioned because before the temple was built, the tabernacle for 369 years dwelt in Shiloh, which was Joseph's territory. So it's as if Moses is taking everything that has to do with the temple, Judah, Levi, Benjamin, and Joseph, and grouping these four sons together. Because he's taking everything about the temple. And that's amazing because Moses prophesied all this about 500 years or so before the temple was built. It's pretty amazing. Very prophetic. Another thing. Who can name two famous Benjamites in the Bible? Two famous Benjamites. Saul, right. King Saul, okay, and then Rabbi Shaul, Rabbi Saul, who also is named as Paul. By the way, you all know that Saul's name didn't get changed to Paul. You all understand that, don't you? Some people think, oh, he became a Christian, they changed his name to Paul. No. Every Jewish person has two names. He has his Hebrew name, and then he has the name that's used in whatever culture he lives in. Paul Paulos was a very common Greek name. And in fact, Jewish people today, they have their Hebrew name, the one that's used when they're called up to the Torah. That's used on their ketubah. It's used at their Brit Milah when they're circumcised. It's used with their bar bat mitzvah. Okay, they have their Hebrew name. But the name that they're called at school or the name that goes on their legal documents and so on their driver's license is the name that's used in the culture around them. All right? So Paul's the same way. His Hebrew name was Shaul because he was of the tribe of Benjamin. He was named after King Saul. But in his Greek affairs and encounters of the Greek culture, he was called Paul or Paulos. All right? Everybody got that? He doesn't have two names. His name didn't get changed. He had two names. You have to take these two characters. King Saul, who started out loving David, and then turned sour against him and did everything in his power to kill him. And it's almost like the story continues with Saul in the New Testament, who starts off, when we first encounter him, he hates the son of David and doing everything he can to kill his followers. The Benjamites, so to speak. But God does a work in his life, and then he loves the son of David. He loves Yeshua. It's almost like what went wrong in King Saul's life is corrected in Rabbi Saul's life. And you'll sometimes see this, where something that goes south in somebody's life, it's almost as if you see it corrected in another person's life. How about Rachel, Benjamin's mother? Joseph and Benjamin's mother. Now here's the one that Jacob loved, you know, and he worked 7 years for, plus another 7 years for, and just loved her, but she stole her dad's idols, she lied about them and hid them, and you know, she had some problems. And then when Benjamin's born, oh, this is Benoni, son of my sorrow, and she dies. You know, another person kind of comes along to complete Rachel's life. Ruth. Because where does the story of Ruth take place? Bethlehem Ephratah. Look at Ruth chapter 4. Same words are used. And it's almost like what Rachel could not quite see and grasp. And she went into idolatry and she embraced idolatry there. We see Ruth leaving all that and coming and attaching herself to the Lord of the harvest. Now, she attaches herself to a man of the tribe of Judah, to Boaz. But it's in Bethlehem Ephratah. And she becomes the great-grandmother of King David. It's interesting to take the two lives. And they even start with the same letter. And it's almost like one brings correction to the other. So, just a little footnote there. All right, Benjamin, interesting character. Couple other things here, then we'll close. I know there have been some hands up, and then we'll take questions. I want to draw our attention to something that might have been a little confusing. A couple weeks ago, I mentioned that Jacob never made his way to Seir, right? He never made his way to Seir, where Esau lives. And yet, in chapter 36, when you read this, it talks about how Esau, he'd taken all these wives, and in verse 6, 36:6, says Esau took his wives, his sons, his daughters, and all the members of his household, his livestock, and all his animals, and all the wealth he had acquired in the land of Canaan, and went to a land because of his brother Jacob. For their wealth was too abundant for them to dwell together, and the land of their sojourns could not support them because of their livestock. So Esau settled on Mount Seir. So it sounds like this all happened later. What this chapter is talking about is something that happened much earlier. Chapter 36 is like a history of Esau all packed together in one chapter. Because if you go back to chapter 32 and chapter 33, Esau was already living in Seir. And he invites Jacob to come and see him in the land of Seir. And Jacob says, I will come and visit you at your home in Seir. All right. So this chapter is describing something happened long ago, probably before Jacob even left home. All right. So I just want to make sure we get that correction made. Brian, who's so astute, pointed this out because it seemed like a contradiction. And so I did a little more studying on it to make sure it wasn't. Okay, I saw a couple hands up. Let's take a couple questions here for your close. Yes, Robin.
What is the significance? First of all, when he and Rachel had anguish that she was born, she died. But then there are prophecies and words in scripture that includes the voice crying out for the ground for children. What is that about?
Yeah, what is all this about Rachel weeping for her children? And it talks about when Babylon came and conquered the land and took so many people hostage, and that they passed Rachel's tomb and the prophet. Is it Jeremiah, I believe? I think it's Jeremiah, who talks about Rachel weeping for her children because they passed right by her grave. And because she died in childbirth, she's seen as one who experiences like a continual sorrow for children, whose her death and her sorrow was based upon children. And so when she sees these children being led into captivity, she's continuing to weep over them. There's more to it than that. I don't quite get it all. But also in that same area is where Messiah is born. It's almost like Rachel, this is the pain she experienced in childbirth, and seeing her children, descendants being led past to her, great-great-great-great-grandchildren being led into captivity, she's weeping over them. But Messiah comes, because what's Messiah's job? To bring them home. Yeah. And so it's almost like, Rachel, your tomb's there, but there's a day coming, figuratively speaking, you're going to see us parade back past your tomb, coming home. So there's more to it. I don't get all the prophets always are still very mysterious to me. Yes, Bonnie.
When Rachel searched for dad, God, so to speak, Laban came and asked Jacob when he searched all the tents, and then Jacob said, will die.
Yeah. Right, and that's probably why she died then. Yeah, we brought that up a couple weeks ago. Yeah.
Okay, and then Herod's temple, we had no need to be for the Shrine of Glory because Yeshua was walking in the temple.
That's true. That's true. Yeah, the Ark of the Covenant wasn't there, but the true Ark, the true container, so to speak, the vessel of God's glory was right there. Absolutely. Absolutely. Another thing, too, if you remember, earlier on, Rachel said to Jacob, says, if you don't give me children, I will die. And so God gave her one, and she did. Anyway. So, yeah, it's a lot of threads all coming together. All right. Okay, well, let's close in prayer then. Father, thank you so much for this time together. And I pray, Lord, you would give us clarity. Help us to be better disciples, to embrace your Torah and to keep aiming for the bullseye. Lord, I pray that you'd open our understanding and begin to appreciate more and more the glorious heritage that is ours through our Messiah, Yeshua. And that the things that apply to Benjamin, the blessings that are his, and he didn't do anything to deserve any of them. All these things we read about Benjamin are all from grace. There's not one single thing he did to deserve one of them. So Lord, in Benjamin, we see ourselves. And you've made us your children of the right hand. And you've made us beloved. Lord, we don't deserve that, but Lord, help us at least to be grateful for it and to recognize its truth and to give you glory for it. So, Father, if you need us for nothing else than for your patience and your love and your grace and forgiveness and mercy to be displayed, then, Lord, we say amen. Use us for that. And we do give you praise even now. In the precious name of Yeshua, amen.